at Segundo here, and I...
Pat?
Doris, this is not the time. You see, I'm...
Where's my alimony?
Not now, Doris. I'm about to introduce a porn star, something I've been waiting to do since show number one.
If you don't give me my $587.32 alimony check right now, Pat, your holiday invite... with special benefits, will be rescinded.
Doris, I'm on the air. Can't we direct these personal matters away from the microphone? You know, don't ask, don't tell, just like that Bill Clinton fellow proposed. If you catch my drift, listeners, I'm so sorry.
I'm waiting, Pat.
And so are our listeners. Our young roving correspondent talked with who? Nina Hartley, as it turned out.
Pat. Have you been a little vigorous with the VHS tapes again?
Doris, please,
You can have the real thing back. For only $587.32. I'm younger than that trollop.
Producer, please, just press play.
I'm waiting, Bat.
So I am here with Nina Hartley, author of Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex. Nina, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
You're my first sex guest. I'm very happy about that.
Oh, how great.
But I wanted to ask you, what is Total Sex, or why did you stumble upon Total Sex? Because at the beginning, you kind of suggest in the introduction that some sections are for some people and other sections are for other people. So, and total seems a really sort of peremptory adjective to use. So what's up with that?
Well, total sex doesn't leave you craving chocolate when you're done.
Okay.
The form total sex takes is unique to each person or couple or triple or group. But I call it total sex because it encompasses the mainstay of most sexual practices. It touches on most things pretty well, and it leaves plenty of room for exploration of the more esoteric things. I'm a very wide-ranging sexual creature, but I do know that many people are a little less broad-ranging than I, and so I did try to make it able to speak to the so-called regular person.
Sure.
Who is not identified as a quote-unquote kinky or freaky or pervert individual, but it's the regular person who would like to be more comfortable with sex and to get more pleasure out of it in his or her life.
Yeah. Well, you split the sections up into basics and then options and, you know, things like
extras.
That. Extras, yes. And I'm wondering, though, I mean, you know, well, again, we're dealing with this kind of weird sort of modifier. I mean, the problem with sex in general, I would say, is that, you know, people don't realize that something like vanilla is an acceptable term and something like being a little on the wild side is a crazy term. So is there any kind of way that you think that this book, or do you have any sort of prognostication on how we can bridge the gap between these sort of two schools or two mentalities of...
Yes, actually I do. It's a good question. My goal, what I support in my work and how I talk to people, is to encourage each person to understand, acknowledge, and accept his or her sexuality for what it is, and then find ways to make connections with compatible others. The most important aspect of total sex is rooted in self-acceptance. We no longer need to judge other people or feel shame about what we do or who we are. Who we are and what we do are two different things. I may have a particular sexual identity or sexual predilection, but I don't have to actually physically do it in the real world. But if I know this about myself, then it can stop haunting me or driving me or influencing me in a negative and unpleasant way simply because I have issues over it. So the most important aspect of total sex is to help people relax already. It's okay. It's just how you are. It's okay. Because our culture spends a lot of time telling people that they're not okay in all kinds of ways, and especially sexually. But humans are very sexual creatures, and when that part of ourselves is not calm, then it just disturbs the force field everywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, the permutations of sexual dis-ease are wide-ranging, and they reflect intimacy, they affect the quality of our relationship, they affect the quality of our intrapersonal relationship. They affect our confidence and our self-esteem and our happiness, and all. It's really essentially located. Human sexuality is essentially located when it is a well thing, meaning I accept myself, I'm integrated, I know where it fits in my life. It frees up a lot of energy, and when it is not integrated, it just kicks everything in the knees.
Well, talking about sort of sex being sort of an intricate, almost essential, I guess, or indelible kind of part of the culture, you come from the porn industry, and in this particular book, you constantly make reference to the fact that porn films simply do not portray how sex really is. You have a section in this book on foreplay. You point out repeatedly that they have this kind of sort of, you know, construct, this sort of like, you know, so-called, you know, the thing that people, that, you know, often lonely people and sometimes couples turn to for imagination, and yet it doesn't reflect the realities of sex. Given this kind of divide, how is there a way for perhaps more realistic porn, or is there a way for... What is your answer to this conundrum?
Well, porn's not supposed to be realistic. Porn is fantasy. I've long called it live-action cartoons.
Yeah.
Your shirt is brown. I must have you. Wait, no, I forgot the pizza money. Oh, the cable boy.
Yeah.
So in our fantasies, in our minds, sex needs no justification. I'm horny. I'm going to have a sexual thought, and I'm going to pleasure myself. And so some people like to read sexual thoughts. Other people like to look at photographs or drawings of sexual activity. And other people prefer to look at moving pictures of sexual activity. But porn, the ubiquity of porn is that porn is primarily made by and for men. Although couples and women are an ever-increasing market share, its biggest customer base is still going to be men, married or not, mated or not. And if you look at the construct of porn, it is a reflection of male angst about it. So in real life, sex, quote unquote, sex, is hard to get for men.
Yeah.
You have to go through this hoop or have a relationship or tell her you love her or be tall or rich or good before maybe she might consent to maybe getting naked with you. So it's difficult. So most men do not get to have partner sex as often as they would desire to do so. It's hard to come by because the idea of sexual scarcity is an artificial social construct, and so women are taught to avoid, quote unquote, giving it up, and men are taught to try to get it whenever possible, except the very stressful thing. So in porn, it's male fantasy. Sex happens because she wants it. And she wants you, and she wants it now. And it's not a bad fantasy. It's like a housewife fantasizing that, you know, Mr. Clinton's going to come in and clean her kitchen for her and leave, or whatever other fantasies we have where our life is not this way, so we want it to be this way, a different way. And so porn reflects the idea that women have a sex drive as well, and that women want it too, and that she wants it with you.
Yeah.
And that's not that. So that's why porn is the same four stories over and over again. And it is not meant to be deep. It's not meant to be socially reflective. And so realistic porn doesn't work because, you know, I don't want to go down on you. You know, didn't you shave first? You know, put out the cat. You know, sex in real life often is fraught. And in our fantasy world, we want it to be easy and fun and nice and not a problem for anybody. So it's perfectly acceptable in my mind for porn to be unreal. In our culture, which does such a lousy job of educating people about sex, it unfortunately has become a de facto sex education focus, which is wrong. It's not meant to do that. My educational tapes are designed to be educational and hopefully sexy as well, but they're designed to be explicit and educational. Here's what it is, here's where you find it, here's what you can do with it. So that you can get some understanding, so next time you're with an actual body, you'll have a little more confidence on how to touch it and where to look for things and what to do. But porn, quote unquote, realistic porn is not going to be common. The closest we come is amateur porn. We have non-professional people acting out a fantasy or doing something fun and hot and filming it. And that has a sweetness and an energy to it that is very, very nice. But even amateur porn is still, we are going to make a movie. We know there's a camera in the room, so we're going to be on our best behavior, make sure that we're groomed and shaved and plucked and whatever we're going to do, because we want to look our best. And in real life, in married, you know, married sex, off the sex sometimes is that way. Sometimes it's just something you do well in 10 minutes so you can both go to sleep. I mean, you know, the reality of sex over a long relationship. Sometimes it's sublime, sometimes it's pedestrian. In porn, it's supposed to always be sublime because it's a fantasy.
Well, of course, but at the same time, you point out in this book, there's two things that come to mind, and that is that cunnilingus is often performed wrong, or at least more for, so that the camera can actually view the lapping tongue as opposed to the full sort of mouth down there.
Right.
And also the reverse cowgirl position. From an aesthetic standpoint and from a reflective standpoint, it looks fantastic, but it's not necessarily comfortable.
Right.
So given that these sort of precepts, these sort of almost kind of conjuring tricks about what, you know, what sex is that, you know, and the fact that our society is so sort of repressed and that we don't have enough sort of education about it, how does, I guess, your book and other books along the lines kind of come to sort of correct this? Because, I mean, it's like, it's one thing to sort of, you know, kind of advocate fantasy, but at the same time, there's not much educational value in fantasy except you kind of get in touch with your own, perhaps, desires or your own sorts of wishes and your own sort of tendencies. But maybe you could answer to that.
In a nutshell, the question, you had to say three questions in there.
Yes, I did.
So, pardon me.
No problem.
So can you ask a short version of the question, and I will, part one of the question, to go back to that.
Okay. Given the fact, that, let's just go ahead and concentrate to this.
Okay.
Given the fact that porn serves more as fantasy as opposed to education, and that it is a tremendous influence upon people, it's their sort of guiding kind of place for them to sort of learn new sex moves or get in touch with vagaries that they really just, you know, don't know about. They see this and they go, oh, wow, this is fantastic. How does your book, or how can that impression be sort of corrected in society? Or is your book kind of there?
My book is there for that. I talk, every other chapter, I remind people porn is a job and a fantasy and a game. It's not how real people actually happen in real life. And if you understand that you can enjoy adult material, you can get off to it, you can even find things that you might want to try, but know that how you manage to create the activity in real life with a real human is not going to be like the movies.
Yeah.
It's going to actually involve real people, real negotiation, real feelings, real consequences, positive or negative. And just to know that. You still might be able to do that anal sex thing, but it's not going to happen like it happened in the movie, because we're pros, and all that stuff, all the preparation is edited out, all the mishaps and the bungles and the slips and the oops, all gone. And real life sex is messier, and it involves people and feelings and clumsiness, and I've fallen off the bed, all stuff happens. So you have to be able to have a little bit of humor when it comes to real life sex, even though it's a serious business. If you can't laugh about how at some fundamental level how sort of funny it is, then you're going to be in for a big disappointment, because sometimes sex is sublime and it's meaningful and it's moving and it's potent and it's all that in a bag of chips, and sometimes it's just a goof. And sometimes it's humiliating, and sometimes it's terrifying, and sometimes it's scary, and sometimes it's messy, and sometimes it's disappointing. And sometimes all the same person within a month. I mean, it all these things. So porn is consistently at one level of supposed pleasure and fantasy. It's always absolutely perfect, absolutely great, absolutely hot, absolutely wild, absolutely balls to the wall, all these things. Whoa! But it's a story. And so I really would hate for people to ever think that, gee, it didn't go like the movie, what's wrong with me? Yeah. That would never be something I want. At the same time, I would never want anyone to think, well, they did it in the movie, why can't you do it? Because it's a movie, and I'm not a movie star?
Well, you know, we could talk about the whole notion, and you kind of get into this a little bit in the book about how they go basically from cunt to ass, really just, you know, without any kind of, like, transition. Or, you know,
woo-hoo!
or your standard sort of, you know, here is your scene, here's your exposition. Mm-hmm. We're going to have the three different positions in this particular scene, and it's always those three, you know, it's always some variation of three. I mean, it seems very much this kind of weird, I suppose this kind of, there's a certain sort of semiotics to it that then gets translated somehow, and then a person in their real life has to sort of work these issues out. And I guess, is there any sort of way to kind of get someone's, I guess, sort of the semiotic blueprint that they possibly get inside their head, and they then enact upon their own sort of natural desires? Is there really kind of a way to cure it? Because pornography is omnipresent, you know?
Well, there's no, I wouldn't say there's a way to cure it, but there's a way to ameliorate it, and that would be better sex education, to prevent child sexual abuse so that children are not robbed of their bodies, robbed of their good feelings in their bodies. The idea that maybe we might actually teach men and women how to interact with each other on a human level, to allow men to have feelings and the women to have sex drives, as opposed to this artificial notion of purity or chastity and his supposed studliness. All these archetypes of masculine and feminine perfection are just, you know, horribly unrealistic. Yeah. And very hard to attain, sustain, obtain. And so just also letting people know that, yes, porn is ubiquitous, but it's not real. It's not real.
But people think it's real, though.
Yes.
Some people do.
It looks real because they're human people. It's actually human people, and it is a real penis, and it is a real vagina or real ass. I mean, those are actual body parts. But everything else about it is artificial. The time, the place, what the reason, the partner. You know, most of the part, you know, I'd say about 70% of the partners and 60% of the partners I have in porn, I would probably not otherwise choose to engage in sex with. Give other things being equal, for example, at a swing party. And then about 40% of the people I would and do have sex with off camera for fun and for our own mutual enjoyment. So that is just the biggest thing I want people to understand, is that no matter how much you long for it or how much it seems so cool, it's not real. It's not based in reality. It's based in commerce. It's based in... And also don't forget that porn... Humans have a long fascination, of course, with sexual activity and watching other people do it, but the scarcity of concrete sexual information in the culture and the way that we really terrify and punish people away from their bodies and away from pleasure leaves porn as the only thing that seems to address sex at all in any kind of real way. Everyone else says, don't do it, don't do this, you're an abuser, you're a codependent, you're this, you're that, and, you know, all I want to do is come. Is that so wrong? I don't happen to think it is wrong, but we make it seem like such a big deal. All we want to do is have an orgasm. It's like so laden and fraught. And so, again, it's that if absent abuse and absent mind brainwashing from church institutions, etc., most people would find some kind of natural easiness with their body that they enjoy, that they would, you know, exercise and find a sensual sexual activity that they enjoy, and they would just be, you know, they wouldn't be alienated from themselves. But we really force alienation on people and then wonder why they have trouble connecting later on in life. But the initial alienation is in the socialization of children, especially around genital pleasure. We pretty much alienate most children from their bodies by the time they're 3 or 4. Because we see the child touching his or her genitals, the adult freaks out, the kid goes, what? And then the wound starts. And porn feels, you know, porn is like a stopgap for the wound, but it doesn't really fix anything. It's like we create a need in people for connection and for pleasure and for human contact, but give them no tools by which to actually make that happen in real life with the real person, where it really needs to happen, where it matters. And so porn, you know, most porn you see is debased because our culture is debased in this way. And entertainment is debased in this culture.
Well, there's also another interesting transition. This goes back to my initial question about, like, sort of the spectrum of, like, whether you're vanilla or whether you're into various other things. And all of them are okay. But Naomi Wolf wrote this really interesting essay a couple years ago, I believe. And she sort of pointed out that porn has this very interesting influence if you are a woman and you are dating someone, in that the man will now sort of expect, you know, will expect immediate blowjobs and, like, you know, more intricate sort of maneuvers, and how there's this constant sort of race for some women who are, you know, just kind of, you know, basically indoctrinated in the basics to actually sort of, you know, meet this particular challenge. So there, porn then has this very sort of interesting sort of side effect. But then the question becomes, are people sort of having these sorts of, you know, extracurricular sort of fringe benefits on top of the basics kind of, I guess, sort of forced upon them?
No, no, I don't agree with that. Yes, the guy may say, I'd love to do this thing I saw in a movie, but she has to have good boundaries to go, you know what, not interested. And it's not porn's fault if she feels pressured by him to do something she doesn't want to do. That is the quote, so-called, I won't say fault, that is the product of her upbringing and her ability to set boundaries, her ability to have self-esteem to say, no, I do not wish to do this. Thank you, I'll leave now. Maybe later, let's start somewhere else first. Hello, I'm human, I'm not a movie. So if he's so loutish and so socially clueless as to think that just because he has a woman with him that he's going to get this, then he is also at fault for being a social idiot. That's not porn's fault that he's a social idiot. And it's not porn's fault that she feels upset or insulted by his request. He is socially inept, and she needs to, instead of feeling pressured or insecure enough to do it when she doesn't want to, needs to know how to say, you know what, thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
And it's not porn's fault if a woman is insecure enough about her desirability that she will agree to do sex acts that otherwise do not interest her. So that for him it's a psychological issue of socialization. For her it's a psychological issue of boundaries and self-worth. Porn is outside of both of those things, and I firmly believe that porn is outside of both of those things. Porn is a mirror, not an engine of culture.
Sure.
And so, again, if we give young people better sex education and socialization, then they will know how to separate fantasy from reality. And how to actually, instead of saying, whoa, nice Hooters, to go up and say, hi, my name is Joe, what's your name?
But at the same time, it's a really kind of curious thing that sex as it exists in American culture. I mean, you know, I we still have things like Hooters, you know, that sort of exist everywhere. We have a Hooters here in Fisherman's Wharf, which is, you know.
At the hoot.
yeah, very, very interesting. And so we have this kind of interesting sort of, I mean, you know, we have titillation on one hand, and then we have the forbidden fruit, and then there's porn, which sort of, you know, kind of reflects. But then there's, of course, like porn that is extreme porn that is now becoming increasingly sort of more like, how far can we push the envelope?
And it ceases to be erotic at that point, becomes a question of made you look.
Yeah.
And part of porn, part of art's role, capital A or small A, is to be transgressive. If it doesn't, at some level, hit you in the gut, it's not doing its job. I don't particularly like porn that is transgressive for transgression's sake. That doesn't appeal to me. So I don't like the hostile porn that I see. I don't think much of the hostile porn is actually meant to masturbate to. It's meant to, oh my God, I can't believe I saw that.
I guess I wanted to sort of frame this in relation to this notion of education.
Yes.
And how porn is almost the only education that exists, because, you know, you're dealing also in a lot of various sort of school districts where, you know, you have to get parental slips, or there's some sort of legislation that is on the books that prevents, you know, people from teaching sex education. There was, of course, Jocelyn Elders many years ago, you know. I mean, what can be done? I mean, really, is there any sort of, you know,
What can be done? It's not going to be done on the governmental level. I don't know when the abstinence-only so-called education is going to be dropped from the curriculum. I don't know when they're going to let that go. I don't know when they're going to stop censoring family planning clinics from mentioning other forms of birth control besides abstinence. This is religion running politics. I don't think that's a good mix. What is to be done? Better sex education. Vote the suckers out of office. Vote the right suckers into office, and agitate at your local school board level for better education opportunities. I'm not a parent.
I know.
So I know that I would be very upset as a parent if my child came home with some of the quote so-called information that they give out these days. I'm all for keeping young people safe from things like death and babies. Excellent. But we cannot keep young people safe from pleasure and experimentation. Their bodies are leading the way there. And Mother Nature trumps culture every single time. And when you have urges, it's better to have an understanding of where they're coming from, how can they be safely directed, in what way is it acceptable to express them, under what circumstances, opposed to just don't do anything. You cannot tell a young person to just not do anything. It's not practical, because, you know, you tell a child not to do something, and then at 14, he or she's crawling out the window at night, going and running around like a crazy person, instead of being able to bring the boy home, have him look dad in the eye, and go upstairs. You know, there is it is natural for young people to want to experiment with and learn about intimacy with people of their own age. I would say, you know, for the most part, with few exceptions, bring back the idea of the 50s of heavy petting and take away the shame and the guilt.
Well, now it's blowjobs. Caitlin Flanagan, I'm not sure if you saw that essay where she basically was shocked and horrified that, you know, 15-year-olds are like, you know, going ahead and, you know, having oral sex. No, you know, they're doing this and often in lieu of losing their virginity.
I think at 15 years old, I was very interested in penises and boys, and the idea of oral sex absolutely fascinated me. I had very little social skills. I did not know, for example, how to talk to a boy or negotiate, here's my boundary, I'm doing this but not this. And so I didn't do anything. But at 15, if I had felt more confident, I would absolutely have been interested in blowjobs because I was interested in boys and interested in penises. Intercourse, it's a bigger deal. I mean, baby and death. I mean, that then was just babies. But, you know, death and babies, So it's a lot for young people to handle. So and I would prefer that most young people under 16 or 17 refrain from intercourse and then learn about their bodies, learn anatomy, and then experiment with pleasure and how to negotiate and how to recognize their boundaries and how to set their boundaries and just all the things that a young person has to do to become an adult.
But that's the problem. You can't determine the timetable, and they'll go ahead and start of their own accord.
If they're told, if it really is because they are maturing early and are not doing it for social, and not doing it because they're lonely at home with parents who are not paying them attention, and not doing it just because they feel uncool and not going to have friends that they don't do it, but if they're genuinely curious about sexual matters, I don't see an inherent problem with that among peer groups. But what's more important then by the time a person is 12 that they understand how bodies work, how and what about feelings? What about if you like this boy, you like this girl? What about if you do, you know, what about all this? And give them tools so they can make their own informed decisions. Ignorance is not equal innocence. Ignorance is a recipe for disaster. And ignorance is a recipe for not using birth control when you finally do have intercourse, and you know, and ignorance leads to all kinds of problems because I didn't know. And so we do our young people no favor by keeping them from information, practical information that helps them remain safe in the world. I mean, at 12, I was interested in looking at naked people. I didn't want to do anything, but I wanted to see naked adults. Just, oh, okay. I wanted to watch naked men walk around and sit down and cross their legs. I didn't, what happened to it? You know, when a guy crosses his legs, what does it do? Where does it go? I didn't know. I didn't, wasn't around naked adult men. And so there was no place, of course, in that time for a young person like myself to be around naked adult men that wasn't a sleazy, exploitative, illegal situation. So I was, my curiosity went unabated, I mean, unsatisfied. But I'm also from the 70s, from Berkeley, and so I did get to read a lot of the new theory about sex. Xavier Hollander, Joy of Sex, Betty Dodson, Jermaine Greer, and Nancy Friday, and all those people. And so the more I knew intellectually, it's like, okay, I get it. There's you can have a construct about to say, okay. So I started getting my mental framework about how did I think about sex, what did I think about sex, what did I think I might want to do, because I got information from books that said this is what's possible. Oh, okay. And so I was able to tiptoe around it and make my peace with it, and then start experimenting when I was 18. If I had had no information at all, it would have been just too big and too scary. Yeah. And I wouldn't have known where do you start? How do you do this? I don't know how to do this. So information for young people, these people get upset that, well, if I give them information, they're going to go do it. If you don't give them information, they're going to go do it and they're going to get hurt. Yeah. If you do give them information, they'll probably delay it because it won't be such a mystery, and then when they do finally do it, they probably won't be hurt so badly. I really don't like it when adults project onto young people their own fears and their own judgment about sex matters, instead of looking at the young person and saying, here's an individual person who's soon going to be an adult. I need to help him or her, give him or her tools so that he or she can actually make good choices in the world, as opposed to I'm going to dump my fear on them and hope that they don't fuck up too badly.
Yeah.
I just can't stand it.
Well, this brings up an interesting sort of dilemma I wanted to talk with you about in the book, because, okay, you have a lot of interesting sort of technical nuts and bolts in this book. few things I picked up, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But also, you know, you also kind of suggest that, you know, a sex life should be sort of spontaneous, or it should continue to sort of, you know, guys, we can, we know when you're doing this by the numbers. I wanted to sort of ask you, and it's not necessarily raised in the book, but how can sort of a knowledge of, like, having never enough information is enough, you know, versus, well, okay, once you've sort of, you know, there is something to be said for screwing up. There is something to be said for making mistakes. There is something to be said for sort of being spontaneous in lieu of those mistakes and kind of getting to know each other a little bit more. So how do these two things...
The two are not anti-theoretical. Because no matter how much you know on paper, it's still two humans, quirky, imperfect, humans. And you're going to make mistakes, but it shouldn't be making the mistake of not having clean, smooth fingernails. It shouldn't be the mistake of biting when you should be sucking. It shouldn't be the mistake of, you know, breaking a tooth instead of kissing properly. It'll be the mistake of more funny, get it overable things, you know, things that aren't so hugely serious. You know, the wrong, you made a funny noise, you know, you queefed, you farted, you burped. You're never going to be perfect. Even when I make love with my husband, and we've done it hundreds of times, it's still always, there's always room for an equipment malfunction or something to happen. And so my being an expert or a professional doesn't stop me from having very human sex with human feelings, because the best sex happens when each person shows up as fully present and exposed as possible, and you take it from there. You're nice to each other, you're kind, you're honest, and you see what happens today. And no matter how often you make love with the same person, it's always an opportunity for something new to happen, because it's a different day. If you're not going by the numbers and just, you know, okay, you know, 1, 2, right boob, 3, 4, left tit, really, the only good sex happens when you're fully present and aware to this moment with this person right now. And that is personal work you can do with meditation, you can do with therapy, you can do with all kinds of things. But however a person learns to become present to him or herself and the other person is the fundamental starting point for any good sex. Hard to get, easy, simple, but not easy. But it is required. It is necessary for sex to really be the healing, nice thing that it is, and not the continuation of pain and misery and alienation and angst and anger and resentment and all the things that it can be and has been for a lot of people, including me.
Yeah. Okay, but at the same time, though, you know, one has perhaps a certain number of moves in one's repertoire.
Well, one can always learn new moves, and so in porn, this is where porn comes in. Yeah. You can actually, if you see a move, your partner goes, "Oh, that looks fun. Try the move." I'm not saying that there's nothing to be gained technique-wise from watching porn.
Yeah.
If your partner is watching something and going, "God, that looks hot," and you look at this activity and go, "Okay, I could go there," try it. Absolutely. But the repertoire of moves comes, having a limited repertoire of moves comes from being emotionally stifled and unsure of oneself and not comfortable being one's self. When you're comfortable with your own bad self, the energy of the moment will incite new moves and inspire new moves. If you are closed off emotionally, yes, you're going to fall back onto your rote behavior. But if you are really in the here and now, presently here, new stuff comes up all the time because it's new. It's energy. Hey!
Yeah.
And I read something in a book. I want to try it, sweetheart.
Sure. But a lot of people are going to be sort of, you know, intimidated by, like, you know, picking up a book like this.
They shouldn't be intimidated. There's no pictures to scare anybody. It's just words.
Yes, but it says it's sex. It's like, you know, it's a book entirely about sex. Some people are going to, like, you know, I'm suggesting, I suppose, that the limitation of one's repertoire is kind of tied into the sort of, I suppose, this is a hypothesis, but how daring one is in regular life, or how, you know, how easily pliable a consumer one might be.
It comes down to, for me, each person, most people would like to have a quote-unquote better sex life. Better being a personal thing that means different things to each individual. The place to start creating a better sex life is with yourself. This is an intrapersonal relationship. This is you getting down with you with the help of a journal, a therapist, whatever you use to heal your own, your old wounds, and to come to terms with your life situation, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the stuff you would like to be different, the stuff that is not going to change ever. When you personally have done your homework and have come to accept yourself as you are, that's not to say become complacent, but to accept, I'm here. Here's where I am. Here's who I am. Not what I want to be, what I want to be when I grow up, when I'm thin, when I'm tall, when I'm better hung, when I'm this and when I'm that, right now. And that is personal work. And so the book helps with that. If you have issues about sex or you feel shy or insecure or, oh my God, look at that. Pay attention to that. Read more books. You know, read Carol Queen's Exhibitionism for the Shy. You know, read more stuff until you figure out your own sexual lock and key system. And then when you have that, then so much of our mishaps with other people come out of our own inability or unwillingness to be happy and to accept ourselves and to realize, you know what, it doesn't have to be perfect to be great. You know, perfect is an ever-changing thing, but great means you had a good time and I had a good time and we feel satisfied and supported and connected and close. And that was fun. And it didn't have to look like a movie to be fun, but fun. Sex is grown-up play. Sex is where we're supposed to be able to get to those moments of abandonment and wild and giddy and silly and fun. This is so fun. This is great. And it doesn't, you could be playing naked Parcheesi. It really is not about, you know, what the activity is. It's about the spirit and the energy that you bring to it. And so much of that is your own shit. You know, I can be supportive of you while you handle your shit. I can even play along with the games you might want to play as you look at your shit. But eventually, my shit's mine, your shit's yours. And you have to shovel it, I got to shovel mine. And I cannot dump it on you. I cannot say, I'm really, really bad. What are you going to do about it? Yeah. Well, I'm going to be helpful while you figure out what the fuck you're going to do.
Yeah.
It's not, I can't fix you. You can't fix me. I have to want to fix. I have to want to look. I have to want to address and confront and dig through my personal shit pile. From my experiences and my sexual nature and everything that goes into making me, me, and you, you. So if you have, you know, so don't feel bad if you have a low repertoire of moves, but know that there's a physical component to sex, a physical skill set. Tickle, dwiddle, hump, swivel, lick, kiss, whatever. Those physical skill sets, rub,
the Charleston,
squeeze.
The foxtrot.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you have the physical skill set, and that can be learned separate from emotion or relationship. It's like riding a bike. Here's how you do this. Here's how you do that. Then there's the intrapersonal aspect, your self-esteem, your self-worth, your experiences in the world. How do you relate to yourself, and are you kind to yourself, or do you still abuse yourself with drugs, food, bad relationships, drama, whatever you're addicted to, committed to. And then there's the interpersonal skills. Hello, my name is Joe. How do you do today? I'd love to have coffee. What do you think? And then there is, on top of that, your own social and political belief system. So you may be a freaky ass motherfucker, but if your belief system says you can't do any of those things, there'll be tension there. But it's still just knowing these things. And so everyone develops it. I developed a physical skill set more quickly than I developed any kind of emotional skill set, which is why porn worked for me, because in porn there is no requirement of emotion. There's a requirement of being nice. You got to be polite, but I don't have to love you. You don't have to love me for us to have fun sex together. Okay, so that for me, the physical skill set enabled me to tap into my emotional life. Other people, the sex desire doesn't even kick in unless their emotional button has been pushed. They don't even want to even think about sex with a person until they start feeling feelings for them. I had to go the other way around. I didn't have access to my feelings until I had been handled, touched, moved, you know.
Which is one of the motivations perhaps for writing this book, in terms of, like, you know, if you have sort of an acceptance of your own desires that is, I guess, sort of relayed through this book, that it might actually help you be in touch with your feelings.
Absolutely. So much of us, until we start looking at this, we don't often realize how much we don't like ourselves and how bad and worthless and not worthy we think of ourselves. It astounded me about 8 years ago when I finally was able to recognize I had low self-esteem. What? Nina had high self-esteem, but my real self, the doppelganger, was a person who had low self-esteem in certain areas, and it manifested in my private relationships and how I managed them or did not manage them. It was a shocker to me, absolutely a shocker, and it was it blew everything out of the water. I finally was able to admit, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my, I'm a dope. So, but once I was able to recognize that, then the healing could start, because I realized, oh, there was a problem, and I did have to address it, and it was my responsibility, and I had to stop thinking, what are you doing to me, and look at what I was doing to myself. And so the book is helpful, because I do try always to give people hope that they can figure this out, but also to let them know that it's theirs to figure out. And what I like about body-based therapeutic modalities is that first, the body's ability to experience pleasure is just an inherent good, like I say in the book. Secondly, when we do treat our bodies nicely, massages, hot baths, sensual pleasure, orgasm, partner sex, all the things that we do to feel good, it makes it nice to stay in our bodies and to stay with ourselves. And often when we start feeling distressed, we check out. We eat, we sleep, we take drugs, we do whatever our distraction behavior is. Everyone has a different one. And so anything but to feel our feelings of loneliness and inadequacy and loss and isolation and alienation. We don't want to feel those things. They're painful. But until we can love ourselves truly, we're not going to be able to make efficacious and useful connections with others, because we're going to be looking to them for the wrong thing. Instead of looking to you to compliment something I already have going on, I'm going to look to you to fix me. And there are plenty of people out here who want to be fixed, and plenty of people out there who like to think they can fix people. And they often hook up, and they stay married, they're together for 6 months or 20 years, whatever it is. But no one can fix me. And I stopped looking to be fixed by my partner a few years back, and I stopped thinking I could fix my partner. I can support my partner in his or her journey to fix him or herself. And then not throw a monkey wrench into it. But it's the heavy lifting is personal. I like sex in the body because it's so, also when we treat our bodies nicely, it releases chemicals in the brain that do help calm us and soothe us and make us feel better. And if, as long as we don't do so obsessively or destructively, you can't overdo it. You can't OD on sex pleasure, because you'll fall asleep. I mean, that's, when you finally have had enough, you doze off. As long as we are ethical in how we pursue it and where we exercise it with whom, then there is no excessive use of sex. If we use it to mislead other people or to harm ourselves or to get something out of somebody else, then of course it is wrong and unethical. It will bite you in the ass, and it won't do its magic. It'll do something else. It won't do the magic that it can do, which is to make us realize that we're fine. We're fine. You're fine. I'm fine. You're fine too. You may not feel it yet, but actually underneath all that insecurity is a person who's perfectly fine. And we need to find that person. You need to find that person. And as grown-ups, one of the ways we can find that person is through sex pleasure. Because sex pleasure and orgasm is an altered state of consciousness, and it cuts right literally to the heart of the matter. And so you can go and be in talk therapy for years and years and years, but people's defenses are pretty good. And when you give yourself over to sex pleasure, those defenses are forced to melt due to the nature of the chemical, hormonal, brain thing that happens during sex pleasure. And so the defenses melt, and you can get to yourself easier. You can get into the middle of yourself more easily when you're tenderized that way. And it's very useful.
One last question, because I know you're being completely blinded by the sun right now.
No, it's okay. No, I'm fine now.
I wanted to actually ask you about, you remark upon how you have observed over the last 20 or 30 years that basically some of the more sort of, you know, so-called exotic forms of, like, you know, BDSM and swinging have actually become more mainstream. And I'm wondering if what you perhaps think this represents is this, going back to what we were discussing earlier about how we have the sort of lack of an educational sort of, I guess, safety net, and we have instead people resorting to a private industry that doesn't, you know, actually represent realistic sex scenarios. You know, is this perhaps a result of that?
No, I think that people are doing more swinging in BDSM because there's more access to information, so people who otherwise might not have known about it can say, oh, you know what, that does interest me. oh, I do like this. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's not a mental illness. It's not a sign of my inability to connect or my unwillingness to commit. It's just a sexual preference that I've discovered in myself. Okay. For some people, my need for swinging was instant, immediate. I've never desired monogamy. I've never fantasized monogamous situations. Ever since I realized I was bisexual when I was 14, I knew that I was going to have to figure out what to do with my life, because I didn't want to have to lie to anybody or cheat or anything like that. And the other people who maybe were raised in a more conventional situation and just don't have access to the fact that stuff exists may have longings or urgings or fantasies that confuse them or wonder where they came from. And then they see a movie or read a book and they go, oh, it has a name. There's communities, there's organizations, other people do this. This is great. You know, there's at least a million swingers in the United States, from twice a year to once a week. I mean, it's actually very common variation on an orientation. And same thing with BDSM or kink or leather or DS sex or alt sex or whatever you want to call it. Right, exactly. And lots of people have been driven by desires their whole life, and until they see a book or a movie, they might not realize, oh, that has a name too. Oh my God, all this way. Oh my God, there's other people like me out there. And this is really brilliant. So it's one positive side effect of the ubiquity of porn, is the fact that more people who need to know that certain things exist have stumbled upon the fact that they exist. This is excellent. And all we can hope to do is educate people younger and younger so that they don't have to take that detour in a 20-year marriage before they realize, oh, I'm gay, or whatever the thing may be. Lots of people, you know, they feel lonely in the world, but they don't know what else to do, so they get married and have kids because that's what you do, and that's what mom and dad expect, and that's what the culture expects, but not quite, it's not quite enough, it's not... And they like their partner is fine, the spouse is fine, but they don't passionately love him or her, but they feel guilty about that because the partner's a good person. And then eventually they will find information that says to them, oh, this is it. That is what has been bothering me the whole time. Until I understood the term polyamory, I didn't know what to make of my desire to have multiple partners but not have them be strangers. I like stranger sex, but I wanted partners who are friends. And, you know, some people I see only twice a year, and that's perfect. Other people I want to see once a month. And then the person I married who I like to see every day and make love with as often as possible. And so it's knowing that that is my orientation, and it's not a mental illness. It's not because I have low self-esteem or don't think I'm worth the love of one person or anything like that. It's that that's how I am. I have friends who are monogamous, and you know, we respect each other, but we don't get each other at all.
But at the same time, a lot of people do actually, you know, in the process of figuring themselves out, they sort of, oh, well, I'm going to go ahead and throw myself into sort of sexual circumstances that are not necessarily who I am. I was actually working on a project. I did a lot of research talking with polyamory people. Mm-hmm. And I talked to some people who had actually gotten out of polyamory precisely for this reason.
And again, sexuality is fluid. So you try it for as long as it works, and if it stops working, you stop doing it. And that means you have to break up with a partner because that partner wants to continue the activity, so be it. Some couples come to a separate life situation. Don't ask, don't tell. You know, as long as you're home for dinner and on weekends, you do what you got to do to remain my partner the rest of the time.
Yeah.
Other people, they want more of it, and they have to break up because the one party will not accept a dual life, or just can't go there.
Yeah.
And some people, they don't mind having their partner at home and their little kinky secret over here, and they don't mind keeping their lives separate, and it works for them. Other people want the kink and the love in the same person. And that might mean the breakup of a marriage of long-term standing when the person realizes, you know what, this is not going away. I thought it would go away, and it's not going away. My whole thing with my first marriage is that we were just incompatible sexually, and I didn't recognize. I kept thinking it was something I could fix, and it was an attitudinal thing or a heart thing or a desire thing. And no, it's an orientation thing. We're not compatible that way. And if I knew then what I know now, it wouldn't last more than 2 years instead of 20.
But simultaneously, people sort of shift and change and develop different tastes or different desires, and you know, vice versa, that this creates a sort of interesting sort of disparity. Oh, doesn't it boil down really to communication the entire
time? Yes, thank you. It does involve communication. Also, how much other things are going in the relationship. For some people, they may have a sex desire, but it's not super urgent. It's something they'd like to try or like to do, but it's nothing they must have. And so they are able to compromise with a long-term partner. I tell the story in the book of a couple I know married over 30 years. And they were swingers before the kids showed up, but after the kids showed up, he wanted to keep swinging, but she's lost her desire for that. Very reluctantly, he put swinging down. It was very difficult for him for many years, but he, instead of breaking up, he loved her. She's his wife, and he knows that. So he was willing to go through changes, even if they were uncomfortable changes, because he didn't want to hurt her. So after 30 years, he discovered that he had a real strong interest in spanking. Either end of it didn't really matter. And he finally was able to talk to her about that. And it was very difficult for her because she was not interested at all. But she desires monogamy with him. And so she understood the compromises must be reached. And if I don't want him unhappy or straying or thinking of straying, I need to accommodate this as best as I can. And so the joke is now between them that she'll participate without him asking 3 times a month or so. And he will not expect it more than that. So no begging, whining, pleading, no withholding, resisting. And so she found a way that she can make it okay for herself. And he's realized, you know what? Great. I'll take it.
Yeah. Maybe it's just a matter of like sort of conveying.
And it depends on what's important to the couple. You know,
for me,
in my first marriage, there wasn't enough other good things going on to make the sexual incompatibility worth compromising about. It was just the last straw. It was just the last thing of an already dead, empty shell of a relationship. This couple had 98% going for it.
Yeah.
Long-term love, 3 great kids, very much compatibility, deep, deep affection and regard. And this little thing was able to be teased out to work for both of them because it was a smaller thing in the picture. For me, my lack of sexual compatibility with my first partner was just the last piece of evidence that I was finally unable to ignore. I mean, other things have been talking to me for years about it's not working, and I was doing the la 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 thing, and I finally was able to wake up to that. So every person makes his or her compromise on what is important to him or her.
I'm wondering though if it's not necessarily just compatibility, or maybe you can replace compatibility with acceptance of the other person.
Oh, there you go.
You know?
An acceptance thing. But we can't accept something else. We can't accept someone else's sexuality until we can accept our own. Because especially if the other person's sexuality seems very foreign to us and alien, then it's really just disturbing. And the more I was able to accept myself as I was, the less I felt need to judge other people and the less I felt upset by other people's choices, because I know I can participate or not, I can share it or not. It doesn't reflect on me that they want this thing, and it doesn't reflect on them that I don't want to do it. It's just, you like chocolate and I'm into strawberry, and it doesn't mix. And that's just a nice place to get to, because again, it frees up mental and psychic energy for more pleasant things than wondering, that person is just a degenerate. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with him? What's wrong with us? Why can't I be happy?
Yeah.
And blah, blah, blah.
Gotcha. Well, I want to actually properly say goodbye to you, because we literally have about 1 minute left.
No worries.
on my tape here.
Nina.com. Check it out.
Yeah,
and Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex from Avery. Buy it on Amazon and write a review for me, please.
Wow. I hadn't even thanked you yet. But thank you, Nina. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You're so welcome. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks.
Bye.